Good morning. This joint meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate State Affairs Committee is called to order. Today is Thursday, October 28, 2021. The time is 9 a.m. We're meeting in the Anchorage LIO building in the Denali room.
We're getting started here shortly. Rogers, you'll be kind of running a meeting.
Senator Schauer, I think I hear you in the background. If people who are tuned in with electronically might make sure their mics are muted.
We'll be standing by.
That's good. Thank you.
Senators in attendance in person are Senator Costello and myself. I'll be chairing this meeting, Senator Holland. Senator Schauer was supposed to chair as chair of the State Affairs. He was planning to chair it, but he was unavoidably detained this morning. He is joining us electronically, along with, I see, Senator Keel, I see Senator Hughes, and if I've missed anyone else out there, please feel free to join in. I believe Senator Reinbold will be joining us shortly. And thank you to Mary, our recording secretary, and Vanessa and Doug, our moderators for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. There's no official business plan for today's meeting. We're in the fourth special session of this year, and cybersecurity issues were not included in the call for the session. We did have this opportunity for Mr. Burt Stevenson of, and I hope I got this right, CyberSec Innovation Partners to present information regarding cybersecurity issues and solutions, especially how these issues may impact us here in Alaska. When I last checked, today's presentation had not been updated to the state basis website. We hope to get it on there shortly. And I do believe Senator Schauer has already joined us via phone.
That's correct, Roger. Good morning. I'm on the Teams.
Thank you, Chair Schauer. Did you have any comments before we get rolling?
I don't. I want to apologize for not being in person. As you can hear in my voice, I've kind of lost it. So I figure it's better if I stay at home and watch from the computer this morning. But I appreciate everybody's time, especially Mark and his experts taking the time from overseas to help us dive into this topic. And thank you, Senator Holland, for being willing to do a joint committee meeting and taking over running it this morning. So I appreciate everybody's time and ready to get started.
Yes. All right. Hate to interrupt this, brief at ease.
And I appreciate the opportunity to present to you today. And per your statement, I was hopeful that I would have the interjections as I go along, because what I want to do is help to provide an understanding and education on what it is that we find and what we do, and actually why this is important, not only to the state of Alaska, but I see this industry-wide and the many things that we touch and the cybersecurity realm. But with that, I'll go ahead and get started. Like I said, any questions, please let me know. Again, thank you for letting me speak today. I want to start with a quote by John F. Kennedy. It's very appropriate to what we are looking at and have looked at in this cybersecurity realm. There are risks and costs to action, but they are far less than the long-range risks of comfortable inaction. And that says quite a lot. And again, so I'd like to thank you for this opportunity. And to set the stage, I would like to first open with the statement that I sent to Senator Schauer just last month. The state of Alaska has suffered four separate cyber attacks in less than 2 years. We have been informing and providing evidence directly to Alaska over the last 18 months of why. This is because Alaska's current IT and cyber vendors are not providing adequate protection, and Alaska's IT infrastructure is insecure. Now, this is an obvious statement, but unfortunately what we see every day is that the obvious is constantly being overlooked. So over the next few minutes, I'm going to explain and define evidence that we have. These are not opinions. This is irrefutable facts and data that we glean off of servers and websites. And what this shows is the cybersecurity posture of not only, like I said, the state of Alaska, but all industries, businesses, business verticals, and it's systemically causing billions in losses and costs. With that, I'd like to actually diverge for just 1 second. Cybercrime is now the world's third largest economy. So the first and second economies are U.S. and China. And as of 2021, cybercrime will produce $6 trillion U.S. dollars. Now, let me put that into a little bit more context. That is more profitable than the global drug trade, and that is more than all national disasters combined. Now, in this special session on voting integrity, and this report is one of the most important parts of ensuring for voter integrity. If a voter registration or Alaskan Department of Election websites can be breached, which have been and still can be, then all data and information, including the integrity of the voter's identification, is all at risk of manipulation. Now, what that means is it doesn't even have to be the voter or the electoral department or website. It can be any government department because the Alaskan government is interconnected. And what that brings is, and as I will show through examples and as we go through this report, that if there's an access point, the criminals can get in, as they have done, and lie and wait and find other avenues and gain elevated privileges with internals to your systems. And once they have this access, then they can move freely, and that includes access to voter information, voter registration, and then possibly manipulate or steal that data. So again, thank you. I'm honored and humbled to be here and asked to present today in what I feel, what I believe is one of our nation's greatest establishments in the assurance of justice and freedom. I'm an Army veteran and proudly served and hold very dear and true the democracy that we have and defend on a daily basis. And I'm honored that in my realm of experience and professional expertise, that I have been asked to provide this statement to you regarding the cybersecurity posture of the Alaska state government. I'm humbled because of the constant struggle that I have and through my endeavors against multitude of organizations and people that would like to keep this information from becoming known and coming to light. I'm honored to be able to demonstrate and prove with evidence, as I has already stated, and irrefutable data that our work is paramount to the cybersecurity of a company, an organization, a U.S. state, a nation, and to a world. Now, I will explain why the current cyber position posture is in a critical, vulnerable position. This is for the entire Alaskan state government, and it requires immediate remediation and addressing. Alaska has been repeatedly attacked by so-called highly sophisticated cyber criminals, possibly from adversary nations. Now, we are aware of four reported cyber attacks. Three of these have occurred after our initial intelligence and sharing of insecure infrastructure with numerous known and available attack vectors. Two cyber attacks, the voter website and the Alaska courts, were warned as vulnerabilities by me specifically prior to these attacks occurring. So a little bit on my background. Who am I, and how does my information and what we provide kind of portray into what it is that we do? So my background, as I mentioned, I'm a U.S. Army veteran. I've maintained a U.S. top secret SCI clearance for 25 years. I've worked within NATO and partner nations, carrying clearances there as well. As my time in the U.S. Army, I served in the National Security Agency. And it was in the National Security Agency that I was actually trained in the Rainbow Series. Now, this was a series of books that were colored various colors, if you're not aware of it, in the 1980s and 1990s. It was developed by the U.S. Department of Defense, and what it did is it started to set the precedents for security with IT and connected systems. So this is where my cybersecurity training started. I finished in the psychological operations, which brought about an interesting twist in the aspect. I was still dealing with the IT and security of things, but I got to understand how we tried to present information to whomever we were trying to present to from a psychological operations perspective. Once I left the U.S. Army, I was a DoD contractor over here in the United Kingdom, stationed at RAF Molesworth, which is the Joint Analysis Center and Intelligence Gathering Center for Europe. Now, there I was the lead for a number of IT systems, including data. But during that, I was frequently brought into IA, again, questioning security and what would happen with certain security settings and data settings, because when you work in these type of environments, spillage does happen, and we would have to clean up or try and prevent this, these types of activities from happening. So again, my cybersecurity and my security understanding of data and manipulation of data and who has access to that data was again, growing and improving. I was part of the DIA Regional Support Center, and I was a lead member for the Regional Support Center Architecture and Design Group for global short and long-term architecture and planning. From there, I moved into vendor and partner solutions as a lead engineer. I would go to many Department of Defense and U.S. Air Force, it was specifics that I dealt with at that time, and architect and design many IT solutions. And that included not only the solutions that I was personally responsible for, but also dealing with many of the partner vendor solutions so that we had a cohesive solution that brought forward to the Air Force and the Department of Defense. So with that, I'm familiar with many different companies and solutions that they offered, but also being on the vendor side of the fence and not the customer side of the fence, there's also the dirty little secrets that you learn within that community of, you know, that they tend not to bring to light in typical environments. And then for the past 5 years, I've been focusing clearly on just cybersecurity. In that time, I've been working with a technology that was developed inside of NATO. It's actually called a truth serum is what they refer to it as. But what was happening, so in two separate instances, one inside a program, a classified program within NATO, and two within the Joint Strike Fighter program in Europe, they were having problems, and they couldn't figure out. They engaged industry repeatedly, time and time again, to try and figure out what was going on. So what happened is developing inside took industry out of the picture. We had a doctor on the inside of electronics and engineering and cybersecurity, and he wrote this package. And what they actually discovered inside of NATO was a Stuxnet-like malware solution. Industry couldn't find it. They couldn't figure out what was going on. So we discovered it through the use of this tool. And inside of the European Joint Strike Fighter, we found ways that the Chinese were trying to infiltrate on a daily basis and steal the data from the Joint Strike Fighter. Now, that's the reason I mention that is as we get further into this briefing, I have a couple slides that show technologies that the Chinese actually did steal, not necessarily from the Joint Strike Fighter, but that they have stolen over time through various Department of Defense contractors and allied partner nations. So continuing with that, over the past 5 years, I've been able to specifically focus and hone my discovery skills to identify the penetration access points on public-facing internet infrastructure. Now, again, and I'll reference this later on, what we are seeing is that pretty much every single cyber attack that you can think of that has occurred, they are sophisticated in the total scope of things, but what happens is the initial access that these cyber criminals and these nation states are using are website and public-facing infrastructure vulnerabilities. This gives them the foothold to get inside. And once they're inside, as I said in my opening statement, then they sit and they wait and they bide their time to move and get the elevated access and privileges that they need, and then eventually come out and run their malware attack or their ransomware or whatever it may be. So over these years, I've been honing these discovery skills and been able to now take a wide scope of what is available and what is out there. I also rank the attack vectors. We call them attack vectors. So there's each individual attack vulnerability we call an attack vector. And they have different ratings from low to medium to high to critical, and also a 1 to 10 rating scale that correlates to the low, medium, high critical scales as well. And these are set by industry standards and international and national standards that we follow and adhere to. So when I provide a solution and say they're at medium risk or they're at high risk, I am coming off of industry and national standards that are agreed upon within the community, and these are not my own standards that I've made. So with that, I would like to continue with the statement that I have prepared and provided for you. The four known Alaska cyber attacks. The first cyber attack was 26th April in 2018. The Alaska Division of Public Assistance, the DPA, as his department of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, was breached with a Trojan virus. It exposed more than 100,000 Alaskan citizens' personal identifiable information, or PII. It was also found to be noncompliant with the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, otherwise known as HIPAA. I provide a reference in the document that I provided, a link that you can look up and reference that cyber attack. The second cyber attack occurred in September of 2020. The Alaska State Government's voter registration website was breached, exposing, again, the PII of over 113,000 Alaskan citizens. This breach was announced in late November 2020. Again, I provide a link to that. Now, in May of 2020, I personally notified Mark and through Mark, the Alaskan government representatives, that this website was critically vulnerable and needed immediate attention after having assisted the FBI with a similar security issue with the central government voting system of www.vote.gov. Now, we found that one of the three IP addresses at vote.gov was redirecting to a Korean university DNS. It actually took you to that web page. And we reported that to the FBI, and they immediately fixed that, and we're very grateful for our discovery and reporting of this. So actionable intelligence was also acknowledged at the state of Alaska. However, we were informed by the state of Alaska that they would not be engaging with us at this time, and this was due to the recent COVID pandemic. What happened is we had just entered the global lockdown, which ensued the global reduction of travel. And there was this reduction in travel from airplanes to automobiles to everybody and businesses was a reduction in the consumption of fuel. And that reduction in the consumption of fuel had a knock-on effect to the state of Alaska, which produces oil, and to the state of Alaska, which receives revenue based off of the production of oil within the state of Alaska. So that's what we were told why they did not want to engage at this time. Now, while we understand that statement, we question that rationale being experts in the cybersecurity realm. In our experience, these exposed cyber vulnerabilities act like beacons to cyber criminals. To ignore a warning of cyber insecurity is foolish and unsafe. Failing remediation could constitute being complicit or being complacent or even negligent, especially when the person or persons informed include chief information security officers and chief various executives, technical information officers, or board members of many in hundreds of thousands of companies that we have notified and spoken to. Now, these insecurities across the country, it is systemic and not confined to a single sector. I have done research on practically every sector I can think of, and I'm happy to discuss any of them with you. I've done healthcare, I've done government, I've done water, I've done critical national infrastructure, I've done insurance agencies, and the list goes on and on and on, and I've done all these. I've done it for many countries. Our partners, including Canada, obviously here in the UK, I do a lot, and Australia. I've done it for the education sector. So that's just to name a few of the many that we have done. So the third cyber attack occurred in April 2021. Malware was placed on Alaska's court system email. On the 1st of April, I emailed the Alaska State Attorney General and the state governor through their the Attorney General. I've got this email further in this report. It was to his generic email address, and the state governor, the only way I could contact him was through his website. Now, I don't know if these two gentlemen did actually receive this or if it was handled by members of their committees, but I never heard anything back from any of them. The only response that I have ever had from the Alaskan government is, as I've already indicated, back in early May of 2020, that they did not want to engage. So a copy of this email is included for reference in Appendix D of this report. And I believe the report that I provided you had a typo error in it. It said Appendix B. But please note the bulleted section, and I will be going through this later. It includes warnings of different vulnerable websites in the Alaskan government, and I have specifically highlighted that the Alaska Courts website was mentioned. Now, the fourth cyber attack breach in May 2021, and this was for the Department of Health and Social Services. Now, even though the data and warnings have been provided to the state of Alaska and shows a systemic lack of cybersecurity, in preparation for the statement, I wanted to again have a more up-to-date and deeper understanding of the cyber posture for Alaska's government. My preparation initially uncovered 98 government websites, including 22 main government departments and organizations linked to the Alaskan government. One example of an organization is the Alaska Energy Authority. What I did is I went to the main Alaska website and started my research into the cyber posture. And in that research, I was able to discover these 98 different subdomains, we call them, or sub-websites off of the main Alaska.gov website. The organizations have a .org ending and not a .gov ending on their website and domain name, but are still linked via Alaska government websites. Now, as a cursory check, I checked each of the main government department websites just as any normal person would using a standard web browser. I opened up my browser, I typed in the domain name, and I hit enter. And what this did is of the 22 government domains departments, 8 came back as not secure, meaning that there was a problem somewhere in the presentation of that web page to my browser onto my computer. Now, that's one-third of the official web pages for the Alaskan government departments that have cyber issues rendering them not secure. Now, I have included a picture of these, and I have also circled in red the not secure. Now, a website can be considered not secure for many reasons. In July 2018, Google made an update to its browser to include the not secure warning, which I have just shown. Now, that warning is in the address bar, and this means that the websites are not using a secure connection, meaning that the data being transferred can be viewed and entered, and it's not encrypted. That means anybody can see what's transpiring between my application and the web page at the Alaskan government. A not secure warning can result for many reasons. Some are simple misconfigurations that can quickly be fixed. Others are more serious, including issues with the encryption and encryption certificates and the keys being used and sometimes not being sent. So the action was initiated by Google, as I stated, in 2018, in hopes to help to promote a secure encryption connection, ensuring that the data being used and in transit on the Internet is encrypted. Sadly, today, 3 years later, this is obviously a configuration missed by many, but capitalized by cyber criminals. I wanted to investigate the presence of additional Alaska subdomains to gain an understanding of the scope of the Alaskan government websites and presence on the Internet. This took me to the first of the recently discovered 98 websites listed in alphabetical order, the AlaskaEnergyAuthority.org. Now, I thought this was a great example because not only was it one of the Alaskan government websites that I found, but it was an organization. So this gave me a perfect opportunity to be able to dive into two immediately. Unfortunately, this immediately started with a not secure website, which I have shown in the screenshot in the report that I have provided. It also identified an additional six subdomains, now taking the total websites needed to be investigated for cybersecurity to 104. In addition, two of the subdomains and the servers that the subdomains were hosted on had an additional open port. Now, every port that is open on a server has potential security misconfigurations or errors. And so that means in our investigations, we have to look at every port that we discover. Sometimes they've been turned off and you know, there's nothing to be discovered. Other times we uncover a lot of hidden vulnerabilities that are not necessarily present on the main web page or port, but because it resides on the same server, now that entire server is a vulnerability through these ports. So I decided to take an initial cyber-rated index, or CRI score, of the Alaska Energy Authority website. Excuse me. So what a CRI-rated index is if you think of the credit rating agencies, they all have a credit report. Well, this is basically the same thing or the same premise, only it has to do with the cyber index of a company. So a cyber-rated index has to do with companies or organizations. Now, this is where the cybersecurity posture for the Alaska Energy Authority started to rapidly spiral into critical. As shown in the picture below, there are critical cybersecurity issues with public key infrastructure, or PKI certificate, used on this website. There are four common vulnerabilities and exposures, CVEs, all with medium risk. They range from 4.8 to 5.5 as a scoring of 1 to 10 on the common vulnerability scoring system. And I always use the latest version, which is the current version is 3.1. And additional cybersecurity vulnerabilities that I have identified. Basically, what this did is this elevated the website and the organization to a critical cybersecurity risk. I want to cover just a couple things while we're here looking at that picture. The PKI certificate has a life of 10 years. Basically, they set the PKI certificate in 2017, and it expires in 2027. Now, working with PKI, the industry standard and best practices that are used is no more than 3 years. Generally, excuse me, months to 2 years. Once in a while, you'll see 2.5. Very infrequently do you see 3 years of a lifespan for a PKI certificate. This shows 10 years. Cyber criminals, this is a common method used by cyber criminals, because if they do get inside of an organization, they don't want to be discovered. And if they can get a PKI certificate issued in the area where they are hiding, one of the best things they like to do is extend the life of that PKI certificate so they don't have to ask for a renewal. So this, it doesn't necessarily mean that there is a cyber criminal in, but it is indicative of cyber criminal activity. So this is a red flag that we see quite often. We have seen PKI certificates with a lifespan of 999 years. As a matter of fact, we are currently working with one of the largest IT and cybersecurity providers in the world. It is an American company, a very large company, and in the past 7 days, we discovered a website similar to what happened with SolarWinds, and again, I'll explain the SolarWinds a little bit later, but this is in flight. We have discovered this, and we are now working with their executives because what we have identified is a website that the cyber criminals have set up and have set, and they're lying in wait, and they're gaining elevated privileges. We already have proven that they have administrative access on their systems. So back to this PKI, this is something that they like to do because it hides them. It helps to hide them. But what we do is we find these, and then we look into it further. And as I said, maybe it's not indicative of cyber criminal, but it's something that definitely needs to be investigated. Now, the four common vulnerabilities, CVEs, when there is a vulnerability that is announced publicly, that company creates what is called a common vulnerability and exposure, and they assign a numerical number to that vulnerability, and they provide a patch. So every CVE that I reference is a known and exploitable vulnerability. It's known to the world. So if I know it, cyber criminals know it. If it exists on a system, it means that it is something that can actively be used by a cyber criminal or nation state to gain access. I also mentioned that it failed data protection laws and regulations. It failed specifically the Europe's General Data Protection Requirement regulation, the payment card industry's PCI DSS banking standards, the healthcare HIPAA, and the NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technologies. The website did not redirect from HTTP, so in your browser, when you access a website, there are two, and I mentioned ports earlier. There's a unsecure port, which is the HTTP, that presents the data to your browser, and it shows you everything that you're seeing. Now, that was where the web interface started many, many years ago. What they've done is incorporated HTTPS, the S meaning secure. And what typically happens a lot of times is they have both ports. So HTTP is assigned port 80, and HTTPS is assigned port 443 on a server. I always say turn port 80 off. Why would you want any unsecure protocol open for use? When you're doing HTTPS, that's the only thing you need to have active. But what we discovered is that not only was port 80 and 443 open, but if I asked my web browser to access that website over the unsecure HTTP, it would not redirect me to the secure HTTPS. And now I'm showing, and one of the reasons I'm showing, a not secure website, and that all of my data and information being used on that website is now perfectly viewable to anybody. Now, since I was preparing this statement for the Alaskan Senate emergency session on election integrity, I decided to investigate why the Alaska State Legislature main website came up as not secure. And the results were simply shocking, and I have shown a screenshot here. And I originally started creating this report in late September, and the first week of October. And just to ensure that my data is up to date, I went back to the Alaska State Legislature website last night, within the last 24 hours, and confirmed that these findings are still sitting on the website. And I'm going to get into this in just a little bit later and break down these security vulnerabilities that I've discovered. So basically, in conclusion, what we have are the cybersecurity posture for the Alaskan state government, but it's not an anomaly. Unfortunately, what we experience in many similar cyber postures in many organizations and industries, including the very IT and cybersecurity vendors in which we rely on, our supply chain. I have additional information that I've prepared in this brief, including in Appendix A, which is the initial cyber-rated index report that I provide to Alaskan senators just last month. In Appendix B, I've included an excerpt of the email that I sent on the 9th of April, 2020, warning of the elections website. In Appendix C, I have an excerpt of an email sent on the 30th of May, 2020 to the commissioner at the Alaska Department of Administration. Appendix D is an email to Alaska's Attorney General and the governor that I mentioned earlier. And again, in that I warned about the Alaska court system and that it was vulnerable. Now, Appendix E, and something that I want to explain here today, it talks about the weaponizing of the Internet and why we are where we are at today. Appendix F, I tie back into weaponizing of the Internet, but I also show the lack of the cybersecurity with IT and cyber vendors that we have and use on a daily basis. Appendix G, one of the questions that I was asked is, you know, what do you see from this meeting today and where can we go from here? And I've kind of put my thoughts into that in that appendix. Appendix H is additional information and resources from third party that I will be referencing. And then Appendix I are our partners like Mark and the Viper transitions. So if there's one connection that I would like to highlight, it's between Appendix E, the weaponizing of the Internet, and Appendix F, the lack of cybersecurity with IT and cyber vendors. In weaponizing of the Internet, I briefly cover Stuxnet and how an unknown Microsoft zero-day vulnerabilities were utilized to gain initial access. And I want to correlate that to the information in Appendix F, where I briefly cover SolarWinds, codenamed Sunburst. Now, understand the direct connection between... Yes, sir.
If we could stop for just 1 second here, while I've got everybody on the line, I have a phone call I'm doing right now because this happened while this was taking place. And Senator Holland, I apologize for the interruption, and I apologize for having a terrible voice. Like I said, I've been losing it the last 24 hours. There is a request if we, and I don't know how we do this, so I'm going to throw this out to the experts here, to move this into more of an executive session because of the sensitivity of the topics. I don't know that is possible at this point, but I'm gonna take a momentary break here, Burke. I apologize because this is obviously something we need to be hearing for reasons that I don't even have to say why we should be hearing this, because we need to know what our vulnerabilities are and how we fix it. But the security concern, which is valid, is that we don't. this is kind of like airing your dirty laundry, right? So where we're vulnerable, come get us. So. Senator Holland, is there somebody you can talk to there, or Naresh and Juno, that we can move this into an executive session type of a thing? And we might have to contact Ledge Legal, which Naresh was doing, to find out how we do that so that we can not make it too easy for the bad guys, so Veteran 2 Burks, I talked military, because I want to continue with this for obvious reasons. This is incredibly good stuff, but... Anyways, I think everybody knows what I'm saying. So how do we proceed from here? What's a way to do this? Does anybody have an idea?
Chair Holland. I tell you what, it's 9:42. We'll probably break for until 9:50. And Mr. Stevenson, I'll give you a chance to go grab a cup of water. I saw you getting a little dry. And I'd also like to thank, looks like Senator Scott Kawasaki's on board now, so... Looks like online we have Senator Reinbold, Senator Thiel, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Schauer, Senator Hughes. And, yes, like I said, we'll take a break until about 9:50. We have this text thread running amongst the senators. We'll discuss my personal belief, and I think this is what Mr. Stevenson's brought up over and over again, is like much of this information is available to the public anyway. So I am not overly concerned with an executive session. But I wouldn't mind hearing from Ledge Legal, seeing what they think about it. So, Mr. Stevens, did you have something to add?
Yeah, two comments on that. So you are absolutely correct. I am not accessing your systems other than through normal web browser interface. Basically, what I'm doing is I'm sending a request to your web page, and I'm saying, what is available to me? And your web page is sending this information back to me, and it's this information I decipher, and I'm finding these vulnerabilities in. Now, my point is, if I can do this, the cyber criminals can do this. Okay, I'm not this all-time special rocket scientist in cybersecurity. I'm a guy that's through my years learned techniques, and you can be sure that the cyber criminals are a lot smarter than I am, and if I know this, they know this. So you are correct. This is actively open, but at the same time, you don't necessarily want to publish what we have. And the second comment that I wanted to make, that is the reason I've kept this briefing with just myself and Mark and actually not invited anybody else in because of the sensitivity of this. I respect that and wanted to make sure that we didn't bring any unnecessary additional entities into this.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. As I mentioned, we'll break until 9:50. We may have to break for a little bit longer than that. But once again, thanks to Senator Reinbold, Senator Keel, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Schauer, Senator Hughes for joining us online and here in person, is Senator Costello and myself, Chair Holland. All right, so we'll do an at ease for about 5 minutes. All right, this joint session of the Senate Judiciary and Senate State Affairs is back on the record. Mr. Stevenson, and I'm going to apologize. I'm going to butcher Mark's last name, but I think Mr. Sayampanathan, am I close? The decision was that we should go into executive session. The complication to that for you is I know you're out of the country. Are you able to call in via phone?
Yeah, sure am.
All right, because I have a 800 number, and we can pass this out to the public because the thing is we can't control the team's connection. But what we can do is if you call in, we can control, we have better control on who's on the phone as opposed to who's connected via Teams. So we're going to break the team's connection. We're going to reconvene at 9 o'clock. Are you prepared to write a phone number down? Pardon me. Digital world. We're going to reconvene at 10 o'clock. And so anyone outside of the U.S. would be best to call in at 844-586-9085. And then the other senators, if you're in Juneau, the best number is 586-9085, and Anchorage is 563-9085. And like I said, we're going to move into executive session at 9 o'clock. We'll give everybody a chance to get their phones up and running. All right, so once again, we're going to go to a brief at ease.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Did I say 9 o'clock again? That usually been up
Mr.
the girl.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure if you could hear me. So the number for those not in Anchorage or Juneau, is that preceded by an 844?
Yes, 844-586-9085.
That's Juneau. And 844-563-9085 for those not in Juneau and not in Anchorage.
Yeah, it's 586-9085 here in Juneau, and I'm assuming that area code is 907. And then 563-9085 for anyone in Anchorage. So,
Shelley, you may have to add the 907 because of the change this past weekend. There's
correct.
More local dialing, so everything's 907 for the prefix now.
Okay, I didn't know if it was 907 or 844, but you're saying it's 907.
Correct. The only one calling in from outside the U.S. would have to use the 844 prefix.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Keel.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before you take up a motion, I guess we just need to take a hot second and think through, the only thing we can discuss in executive session is the stuff that would be a real threat to the state. The vast majority of what we've heard so far, it's just sort of general cybersecurity stuff, and that we can't discuss in executive session. So we need to be real careful with how we split our conversations here. And so if we're interested in the executive session part first, I think there's a great deal that we will also want to discuss in public session. So I just offer that up. It's going to be a difficult thing for you to manage with the gavel, standing by for how you want to split those topics.
Yeah, you know, I thank you, Senator Keel. I don't pretend to be the cybersecurity senator here, but I'm almost curious as if it wouldn't be up to Mr. Stevenson for what he feels. I hate to put this burden on him, but we're all neophytes in this field, I think. And is there any additional portion of this, Mr. Stevenson, that you feel should be discussed in the public portion of this meeting, or should we just move into the executive session?
I'm just looking through my notes right now. I do reference a number of external non-Alaska specific, but the only reason for that is to provide the backing information. I was planning to actually dive into the specifics of the Alaska legislative website and those vulnerabilities, as well as some of the others that I have discussed. So I can keep this pretty much centered on the cybersecurity for Alaska.
And then the other thing to add on this is we are in the fourth special session. We cannot hold any official business, any committee business that's not on the call for the session. So there will be no votes. There's going to be nothing occurring in the executive session, and we're not going to come back to the public and have a vote or anything like that. This is all just for presentation purposes. All right. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hughes.
Yes. I am wondering if we are going to go into executive session and talk about the legislative website in particular, whether it would be all right to have Tim Benizak, our IT director, as part of the executive session?
I believe that would be appropriate.
If I may as well, sir, there are two issues looking. So I was going to talk about the weaponizing of the Internet. That does not correlate directly to Alaska. And I was also going to talk about the lack of cybersecurity with IT and cyber vendors. Again, that does not correlate to the Alaska government directly. I'm happy to go over those now. I'm happy to leave it to you as individuals to read through that because it is in the report. But basically what it does, just really quick, so the weaponizing of the Internet explains how it's not proven, but it's pretty much accepted that the U.S. and Israeli agencies developed a code for Stuxnet. And what I mentioned earlier is that it used a Microsoft vulnerability, a zero day, to get in. And what we have done by Stuxnet was showing the world that the Internet can be used for cyber warfare. So that's the premise behind the weaponizing of the Internet. And I mentioned earlier, and there are two screenshots of the U.S. Joint Strike Fighter and the Chinese passenger airline, and it references a bunch of technologies that they've stolen.
Well,
and the lack of cybersecurity with IT vendors just kind of builds upon that. And the way it correlates back to the state of Alaska is, think of SolarWinds. They had a supply chain into tens of thousands of companies because they provided a solution. So every IT, cybersecurity, hosting, whatever vendor that the state of Alaska uses is inherently a supply chain vulnerability being brought in, making your government insecure. And that's how I tie those two together.
Well, hang on to those thoughts for a second. I see Senator Kawasaki has his hand up. Senator Kawasaki, did you have something to add?
Yeah. Hey, how's it going? So I have a problem with going into executive session with this group. I feel like this should be information that is given to the rest of the legislature. And so I just wanted to say that. If there's proprietary information that's just to the committee, that's great. But again, I feel like this is information that we can find pretty readily on Google. And so I don't know why we have to be in the session or executive session for this.
Senator Hughes?
I believe that, Mr. Chair, that any legislature could call in and be part of executive session now if they wanted to be.
Thanks, Senator Hughes. Senator Kosaki, you still have your hand up. Did you have anything else to add?
Yeah, I don't feel comfortable being in executive session with just a few of us, because this is information that should be provided to all of us. And yeah, I'll probably be offline for a while. And again, I think this is information that we can find online. So I don't know that this is the proprietary information. But if it is, folks can fill me in afterwards.
So the technologies and the information that I use is called OSINT. It's open source intelligence. So it is available on the internet. As I mentioned, it's the interactions of the computers interfacing with the web pages and your browser. So this information can be gleaned by anybody that has the knowledge on how to do this. That doesn't necessarily mean they have the understanding to decipher it and determine what vulnerabilities exist. So, to your point, Senator, it's not quite as simple, and I know you didn't necessarily mean it like that. It's not as simple as just accessing Google and saying, hey, what's this? But yes, you can derive this through the internet. That is correct.
Senator Holland?
Hold on 1 second, Chair. I'll just say, I do doubt that we could get 60 legislators on board this phone call in the next hour. And I think it is our job as the judiciary, as Senate Judiciary and Senate State Affairs Committees, to take an initial look at the data and prepare, and present whatever to go on to, like, the larger body. I think it's kind of impractical to think that we would have to have an executive session for everyone in the legislature. But we'll get that answer shortly, I'm sure. Senator Schauer.
Yes, sir. So that's the what I was going to bring us to here. Our alleged legal director, Megan Wallace, called while all of this conversation has been taking place. She should be calling in now. And what she is going to recommend, but I would like her to have us say this when we get it on the record, is that under Uniform Rule 22, if it has vulnerabilities where it might impact the state, then that's the appropriate venue for us to go ahead and do that. And then hold the briefing for that as well. So I'm going to let her speak, but I just wanted to let you know that, and for everybody listening, and that she should be somewhere where we can get her on the line to provide that legal advice and that guides with what, our IT director is asking as well, just from a security point of view. And I'm happy to go with that, but like I said, and I agree with Senator Holland, we have a responsibility to get this information as legislators so that we know what we need to be doing to fix them and make the state more secure. So over back to you. Megan Wallace should be hopefully called in or ready to talk.
Senator Howard, did you say Megan Wallace would be calling in?
Yeah, she had the number, was going to call into this meeting so that she could provide that advice to us as our alleged legal director.
I see she's called in. We'll go to her right now at this moment. Megan Wallace, can you hear me?
Yes. For the record, Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. I recently spoke with Tim Banaszak, our Chief Information Officer, our IT manager, regarding the issues. I apologize. I missed the beginning of the meeting, but it was brought to my attention that there are some issues that this group wants to discuss regarding these cybersecurity issues that do potentially raise an issue that affects the security of state agencies. And so under Uniform Rule 22B, it would be our recommendation in conjunction with the advice of Mr. Banaszak that these discussions be held in executive session under Uniform Rule 22B. And what I just caught from the tail end of that discussion is that there may be an interest at some point, whether it's, you know, briefing another group of legislators or the public on the issues that are to be considered. And it would be my advice that we delay that until we can have a more deliberative process in terms of what risks there are with the information that's to be divulged to the public.
All right. So are you, I'm trying to follow that. Are you saying that we should probably maybe cover whatever we can continue to cover with the presenters as far as what's, what would not be something in executive session? And then at that point, just curtail the meeting and reconvene at a later date? Or are you saying we're fine with going into executive session after that?
Mr. Chair, it's difficult to give comprehensive advice because I don't know what matters you're going to discuss out of executive session versus in executive session. But to the extent that they concern cybersecurity issues amongst the general state agencies, based on the information that it's my understanding that is intended to be presented, it's our recommendation that that information be presented to this group of legislators in executive session today.
All right. Thank you so much. How about this? A brief at ease.
The Senate, the Joint Judiciary, and State Affairs back on the record. The thought is that I'll give Mr. Stevenson a chance to speak for the non-sensitive issues that he said he was going to cover. And then after that, we still have everybody's still, their team's links are still up. And at that point, we'll go to another brief at ease. We'll take about 5 or 10 minutes, let everybody swap over to the phone lines, and make sure we're set up for the executive session. We'll move into executive session at that point. Anything else from the committee members?
Hey, Senator Hollison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate
this. Just to concur, I see a couple texts there that we're just going to finish up the less sensitive topics first, and then we'll go into an executive session for the sensitive topics at the end. Is that correct?
That sounds great. That sounds like the plan of action.
Copy.
All right. So
before we go back on the record.
Yes, sir.
Senator
Keel had I'm sorry, Mr. Sayampanathan, can you hear me?
I'm unable to, just wanted to let you know.
I'm sorry, Mr. Sayampanathan, would you do me a favor, state your name and affiliation, put yourself on the record, and then restate that? I was having a hard time hearing you.
Sure, this is Mark Sayampanathan. I was trying to respond to something Senator Keel had put in the chat, and I'm unable to participate in the chat, so to respond to him. So just wanted to let you know that.
All right. Thank you. A brief at ease. Organizations out there, you're probably broadcasting a lot.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hughes.
Yes, and actually I want to make a comment about that because whoever is controlling the live stream through Ledge TV, I do believe they're not supposed to be streaming during the outages. Is there a problem with that?
That's my recollection from the committee meetings in Juneau. Is that when we're off the record, the broadcast should stop. So that's why I think we should be cautious with that. All right, so is there anything else from committee members? Seeing nothing, what I will probably do is move back to Mr. Stevenson. Would you like to resume?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, happy to. So I was mentioning the correlation between the weaponizing of the internet, which you were a brief cover of Stuxnet, and how an unknown Microsoft zero-day vulnerabilities were used to gain the initial access. And now I want to correlate that to the information in Appendix F, where I briefly cover SolarWinds, codenamed Sunburst. Now, Senators, to understand the direct correlation between these two are paramount to understanding the problem. Understanding the problem means that...
I'm sorry, Mr. Stevenson?
Yes, sir.
Brief at ease. The record, I apologize for that interruption, Mr. Stevenson. I'm trying to keep all the players in this updated on what we're doing. We had some people wanting to pull the trigger on the executive session. I told them, right now we're going to cover some less sensitive information for whatever time it may take, and then at that point we'll break the team's connections and we'll go to the executive session. But if you would please accept my apologies for interrupting and resume.
Thank you. No problem. So understanding the problem means that steps can be taken to mitigate the problem. The connection that I would like to make clear is that the same methods of exploitation and manipulation that were used by the agencies in Stuxnet were also used in Sunburst. Now, these methods are being used daily against companies and governments to devastating effect. And I can assure you this is happening in every industry. To close this statement, and before I move on to a couple of the appendices that I've mentioned, I would like to dive into a couple data examples, but I want to reread my opening statement because now I hope that the clarity and the understanding of that statement should ring more true and act for the urgent call to arms before the next attack to the Alaskan state government, in my opinion and with the information that I have, undoubtedly, will occur. The state of Alaska has suffered four separate cyber attacks in less than 2 years. We have been informing and providing evidence directly to Alaska over the last 18 months of why. This is because Alaska's current IT and cyber vendors are not providing adequate protection, and Alaska's IT infrastructure is insecure. This is an obvious statement, but unfortunately, what we see every day is that the obvious is constantly being overlooked. Make it go away. It will simply compound the challenges and the costs, which, unfortunately, the state of Alaska has already seen. Now, per this session, and to ensure the integrity of the voting in the upcoming 2022 elections, it is critical to our democracy that we get this right and that we take action. Now, what I would like to do is move into Appendix E, Weaponizing the Internet. It's on page 21 of the report that I provided. So the age of the computer and the internet has developed and rapidly advanced science and technology and for the benefit of the world. To be honest, I'm actually one of these beneficiaries in the medical field. Some amazing examples have accelerated what we can do and the lives and the things that we can save. This computer age has also seen the accelerated growth and reliance on IT systems in our daily lives. Everybody relies on IT systems, whether it's from a phone or as we're doing right now in this video teleconference. It's brought about the internet and the ability to share and use information open and freely in seconds to anywhere in the world. It has provided the ability to have live video chats like the one we are on today. Compared to just 20 years ago, this was practically impossible and required either telephone, satellite, or to actually travel. Now, in all the immense benefits that this has brought, it has also created the weaponization of the same internet. The first real display of this weaponization occurred with the Stuxnet malware used to cause catastrophic effect of the Iranian nuclear facility. To put this into context, Stuxnet was first discovered in 2010. That's only 11 years ago. Now, what I find interesting about Stuxnet is it was developed to attack specific targeted programmable logic controllers, or PLCs, that are manufactured by Siemens. It even goes further. The Stuxnet would not harm any system unless it specifically dealt with uranium and the enrichment process. So it was a very clever code that was developed. And that it's widely accepted that Stuxnet was created by the intelligence agencies of the United States and Israel. So, unfortunately, what we have basically done is created our own worst nightmare. One fact about Stuxnet that is particularly interesting is the exploitation, as I just mentioned, but also of the Windows zero-day vulnerabilities. Now, this should ring a bell, because just this past month, there have been a number of zero-day vulnerabilities that have been in the news. I noticed this, obviously, because this is the industry, cybersecurity, where I am in. But two specifically that I hope that you have heard, one of them was a Microsoft zero-day vulnerability, which included the auto-discover website and function within Microsoft. Now, what makes this auto-discover vulnerability particularly bad is not the fact that it was a serious attack, it was a zero-day, and that the cyber criminals can and have used it, but the fact that Microsoft was aware of this vulnerability for 5 years. I provide a reference link to an article published on the 27th of September by a newspaper called The Register, and it states how Microsoft knew of this auto-discovery for 5 years. We can also learn a lot from the unfortunate and treasonous release of the thousands of classified documents by Edward Snowden in 2013. Some of those documents included classified briefings documents from the National Security Agency. They explain the ability that the United States had to take control of IT systems even after a fresh and new installation of software and firmware. So take, for example, your laptop or any IT system that you have, and you know that it's been compromised, and you completely wipe everything off of that and reinstall everything brand new, standard factory configuration. The United States had the ability to still take control of that system. So what we can discern from this is that the United States had these capabilities before the Snowden debacle in 2013. What this again reaffirms is the complete insecurity of every connected system, especially everything that is information technology. So from 2010 to 2013, and now fast forward to 2021, Alaska's government, just like all U.S. state governments, implemented and became dependent on IT systems throughout every department, organization, district, and incorporated town. All the personal identifiable information and other data considered to be sensitive or classified has been consolidated and stored on IT systems, clouds, databases, and such. This wealth of information is invaluable to criminals for a multitude of nefarious purposes. Now, what I have shown here is a couple slides that I like to use. And if what it does is it shows the clever abilities that our adversaries have and why they continue to hack our systems. Obviously, from a cyber criminal perspective, there is the monetary side of it, which I have mentioned. I mean, the third largest global economy of $6 trillion in 2021. That's staggering in my mind. But it also shows, so the Chinese, and this focuses on the Chinese and the Russians are just as bad. The Chinese have been able to plan strategically for decades. And what they've done is they've been able to, instead of spending all their money on research for pennies on the millions of dollars spent in U.S. defense, they are able to steal the technologies for stealth fighter and stealth technologies that we see in the Joint Strike Fighter and the F-35. What we also see in this commercial airline is all the different components that were stolen from various companies throughout the world that allowed them to piecemeal and put together a better commercial airline, but they didn't have to spend the time and the money to develop those technologies. Now, moving on to Appendix F, I talk about the lack of cybersecurity that is in our supply chain. The level of lacking cybersecurity is systemic across our IT and cybersecurity vendors that we use and rely on every day. I have personally researched over the past 3 years 150 of the top IT and cybersecurity vendors and manufacturers. The systemic lack of fundamental cybersecurity across their plethora of internet-facing websites, domains, and subdomains is a standing example of the lack of knowledge and expertise by these very professionals to close the initial access points used by cyber criminals. I would like to segue right here into something I did this past week. I reached out to a main IT provider, a U.S. company, their CISO in the United States, because I had started looking into them based on some information that I had seen on the internet. Basically, what I was able to discover was one of their VPNs had expired PKI certificates, were running encryption algorithms that can be hacked in 6 to 10 minutes. And the website accessing, so if you accessed the VPN and tried to log in, it was in a not secure state. So I reached out to these vendor and told them, and they did engage and come back, but in the end they decided that they didn't want to proceed. And this is standard across the board in unfortunately, a lot of what we see from an IT and cybersecurity perspective. So now what I want to do is dive into the SolarWinds breach. So this well-known cyber attack and breach was an amazing example of the cunning, patience, and skill that we face in the cyber criminals today, and I've referenced this a few times already. This breach alone has affected over 18,000 companies worldwide, including the U.S. federal government and the Department of Defense. The cost of cleanup of this one single attack is estimated in the billions of U.S. dollars. This attack was so prolific and damaging that it caused the United States Senate to conduct a hearing dedicated to understanding how and why this took place. Testimonies were heard from some of the chief executives and cyber experts from many professional and top-tier cyber companies, including SolarWinds themselves. They answered many questions posed by the U.S. senators. However, the absolute single and most important question was never asked by anyone, not a senator, not an investigator, no one. And that one question, which I have already explained in the research that I do, is how did the cyber criminals gain the initial access into SolarWinds? So while the SolarWinds cyber attack was sophisticated in the total scope, the initial access was not. It was simple. It was by no means sophisticated. What the cyber criminal did is they found a website that they were able to breach and then spoof. So they created their own website and made it look like SolarWinds, and then they waited. And then they got administrative access inside of SolarWinds, and that enabled them to assign a PKI certificate onto the website, making it look more authentic and exactly like SolarWinds. And then they sat and waited their time, and they were able to move internally through the SolarWinds company to finally find an update that was going to be posted out to all its customers. And it was in that updated software that they inserted their malicious code. Now, this is why what I do and the information that I find is very critical. The So the cyber criminals gained access to SolarWinds by exposing readily available cybersecurity vulnerabilities on their public-facing internet web pages and infrastructure, just like the ones that are in Alaska's government. The cyber criminals were able to create and duplicate that website to a different URL, but a website that looked identical to an official SolarWinds website. This tactic is called website spoofing. They were then able to exploit the known and readily available vulnerabilities on their internet systems to gain access, eventually attaining administrative access. Once they had this, they were able to use the SolarWinds IT systems to assign a real PKI encryption certificate to the spoofed website and the added appearance of a valid SolarWinds website. From there, the criminals used their time and privileged access to move laterally within the company and insert malicious code into an update of the SolarWinds software that would eventually be pushed out to their customers. So why was this one question never asked or answered in the U.S. Senate hearing? And what we have seen with the people that I work with, because we've worked with the U.S. government, with Department of Homeland Security and CISA, here in the U.K. with GCHQ and the National Cybersecurity Center, NCSC. But it also stems into the very agencies that I've worked for, like the National Security Agency and Stuxnet. We've known this for decades, and we've used this to our own purposes for decades. And this information we didn't want to come out. We wanted to keep it a secret as much as possible, because what it does is it gives us as a nation the ability to glean information from around the world on our adversaries and what's going on. So that's why this is not a widely publicly available in knowledge. Now, moving on, Microsoft was notified by us in August of 2019 about the existence of hundreds, let me say that again, the existence of hundreds of security flaws inside of the Crypt32 DLL as a dynamic link library. Now, that's one of Microsoft's API modules, and when we go into our special session, I'm going to explain more of what an API module is as I dive into the Alaskan website. So this security flaw was discovered by us. We contacted Microsoft and disclosed the information pertaining to the security vulnerability. Microsoft and their professionals performed their own internal research to try to discover this vulnerability, and they were unable to locate it. They responded back to us stating that they were unable to locate the vulnerability, wherein we replied back to them with further information on how they can try and identify it. Again, Microsoft was unable to locate the vulnerability, and in the end, it took us getting online, similar to what we're doing here today, and hand-walking their cybersecurity experts step-by-step through the discovery of the vulnerability. And this resulted in a patch that was announced in early 2020, and it was assigned the CVE number 2020-0601, and it's for the Windows Crypt API spoofing vulnerability. The severity of this vulnerability is rated as high, with a score of 8.1 out of a possible 10, according to the National Vulnerability Database, latest version, which I have already mentioned, version 3.1. The National Vulnerability Database is a database maintained by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, also known as NIST. NIST is a physical sciences laboratory, a non-regulatory agency of the United States Department of Commerce. And I provide a link for reference to that specific CVE. What is worse, the updated version of the Crypt32 DLL included a minimum of 4 embedded certificates, i.e. vulnerabilities. Now, we know this because we scanned it again after its release. After the CVE was released, the Crypt32 DLL that was being used by ZenMap is a vulnerability scanner that can be found and used on the internet and is widely used in hundreds and thousands of companies across the world. So what we found that was being used in this ZenMap security scanner was that it held 379 certificates with the exact same spoofing vulnerability. A few months later, Microsoft was again contacted by us because I had firsthand discovered critical vulnerabilities on their internet presence in Israel. Excuse me. This is very similar to what I have done for the state of Alaska as well. Now, at this time, we had agreed to act in the best interest of all, and as a conscientious cyber professional, provided the information to Microsoft. We all want to make the world and the internet a safer place, right? Well, Microsoft took the information, and they were able to remove some of the most critical vulnerabilities that we identified. But what remains puzzling to this very day is why Microsoft and many companies just like it, they will not extend the same level of professionalism and engage in discussions on the vast number of other internet vulnerabilities that we have discovered and notified them about. So in context, and as I have disclosed already, we have now engaged twice professionally with Microsoft, providing information to them of critical cybersecurity vulnerabilities, validating our capabilities, and Microsoft still will not engage with the same level of professionalism. Now, as I've mentioned, Microsoft's not alone. Just 2 weeks ago, the Apple iOS Zero Day was released by a vulnerability hunter because Apple refused to reasonably engage and work with them on the fix of the vulnerability. So what we see is, and as I referenced the other IT company just as I started into this, this is a common practice for reasons why are unknown, but it's not just us, but it is a lot of the vulnerability and cybersecurity professionals that try to engage with these organizations and help improve our infrastructure, but we are being ghosted and not engaged. Now, the final example that I would like to provide demonstrating how rife the IT and cybersecurity industry is with the cybersecurity vulnerabilities and their negligence to engage. It will be an example using a Zero Trust Rockstar Zscaler. And how this transpired was, many of you know Jim Cramer, I believe. He's on TV, and he talks about investments and opportunities. And I do believe it was a week after the announcement of SolarWinds, he went on to one of his televised editions, and he said, you know what, if SolarWinds would have been either Zscaler or OKDA, the cyber criminals would have met their match. They wouldn't have been able to do the same thing. And I thought, okay, let me take a look. So over the course of the next few months, what I did is I compiled a cyber-rated index score of over 150 of the top IT and cybersecurity companies. Zscaler was included in this compilation scoring, and they scored an F, having discovered a number of vulnerabilities that placed the company's infrastructure and solutions at unquestionable risk, just like SolarWinds. I contacted a previous coworker who is now the vice president of their federal. He had an employee and a mutual friend contact me. I provided information about the cybersecurity vulnerabilities and was given the contact information for Mr. Desai, their CISO. Following our conversation, I reached directly out to Mr. Desai on the 22nd of January, 2021. He never responded. Not only did he never respond to any of my attempts, including the CEO of the company that I consult for here in the UK, Andy Jenkinson, also reached out to a number of their chief executives, including their CEO, and they have not responded to any of our requests to discuss the information that we've had. So not one response from all the attempted contacts and warnings that we provided of insecurity, including noncompliance to data protection laws and regulations. Now, why do I mention that? So these are global companies, and I've mentioned that we look at the various laws and regulations around the world, and some of the specific ones that we look at are Europe's General Data Protection Regulation, as well as California's Consumer Protection Act, because a lot of the IT industry have their headquarters in California. So what we see is various articles, and I can reference articles specifically, especially in the General Data Protection Requirement, GDPR, of where an organization is in breach of that data protection. And the reason they are is because there are known vulnerabilities existing on their websites and their web infrastructure that make them vulnerable, and the data that they have for their users and their customers is now exploitable by cyber criminals. So with that, I would just like to make a reference to Appendix H, which is on page 26. The first one is an IBM security report. This is a recent report put out by IBM. And in this, they show that two-thirds of all cloud cyber attacks are originating through misconfigured APIs or application programming interface. Now, what an API is right now, if I were to access a company and they had software that I wanted to use, I would go on their website and manage that through their website. What an API does is it allows me to program on my side a set of instructions, and then it's more of a computer-to-computer interaction. So these APIs take out the human interface and allow these computers to start to talk back and forth. And now I can get the information from their solution or their software or whatever it is that they provide through these APIs. Now, the problem with these APIs, and again, we'll get into this in the special session, is the vulnerabilities that they provide. For example, you can put files onto the server at the location of the URL. You can delete files at the location of the URL. That means that I can actually put in malicious code or something to that effect through these APIs, and there's a lot of other exploits that can be done. The second one is a Hacker 2021 report that shows 6% of all hackers are focusing on websites. Now, the word hacker here doesn't necessarily mean bad guys. It also means good guys. But what this is showing is that the biggest breaching area is websites. But even though websites are just called out to the far right, APIs are part of it. The Android and the iOS applications can be part of it because what we do on our phones are accessing websites. The operating systems are part of it because you have to have an operating system on the server to host that website. And it just keeps going in. So these are things that keep adding up on showing why our public-facing internet is really, really important, and it is one that is constantly overlooked for other penetrative and inside solutions. The third I want to reference is a McAfee report. They recently investigated a government agency and a cyber attack that they had. And the quote that I have shown here, which is very appropriate, states that this Chinese APT group, they were able to discern that that's where this attack came from. The hackers broke into the network by compromising one of the victim's web servers. This is SolarWinds. This is Colonial Pipeline. This is the school district in Florida. These are the hundreds of healthcare breaches that we have seen time and time again. They are getting attacked through their public-facing internet. The last one that I want to reference specifically is number five in EA Games. EA Games was breached through cookies. Now, we now know today and in today's environments that if you go to a website, they let you accept or decline certain cookies. Our cookies play an important part in the role of today's internet because of usage. They have been designed to help improve interaction with websites and can track, personalize, and collate and collect and share PII information about each user's session. Cookies can also be extremely dangerous as they contain that PII data, including login ID and passwords, especially if it's on a non-secure website. So as an example of how critical a cookie can be is the recent breach of Electronic Arts, also known as EA Games. The hacker purchased login and password information from a cookie on the dark web for $10. They then inserted that cookie into an insecure and exploitable subdomain and used this to obtain access to EA Games and steal the source code for the new FIFA 2021 game. So, Chairman, Senators, I believe that is pretty much all of the non-Alaska-specific information that I have to share with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. I appreciate the Appendix G, I think it is. Where do we go from there? If I'm understanding this correctly, a lot of the problems with cybersecurity is maybe not with, for instance, the Alaska state agencies, but with vendors that are allowed to take part in the Alaska IT system. But are there any other questions? I see Senator Keel, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A few with your indulgence. I guess the first one is just something I wasn't clear on from the presentation. Were the hacks at Division of Elections and the hack at courts, were those through the vulnerabilities that you identified, or were those through some other vulnerability or system?
So we have not been engaged by the state of Alaska, and we don't know who was engaged or what they discerned, how those attacks occurred. So I cannot answer that specifically. What I can say is we did know vulnerabilities existed that would have allowed access.
Fair. I appreciate that. Maybe a prefatory question to a broader one. I thought I heard you say that the Stuxnet virus was introduced through the Internet. And I guess my reading on that, which is very limited, was that the two primary theories were thumb drive or early installed in the supply chain, but not via Internet delivery.
Correct. So their systems, what they had is, and I use the Internet loosely, what they did is used Microsoft zero-day vulnerabilities, which is across the Internet. You're correct. It was not a direct attack where we went in and hit them specifically.
Thank you, and I appreciate the indulgence, Mr. Chairman. The reason I ask, this has been a really informative presentation. It strikes me that it's kind of just a slice of the broad topic of cybersecurity. And I guess, you know, we didn't talk about malware delivered by email or the thumb drives, ransomware, data encryption stuff. What is the approach that a modern large organization, especially a government organization, ought to take to sort of the 360-degree look at cybersecurity?
That is an absolutely great question, and I'm actually glad you asked it because – cybersecurity, let me step back. So as I mentioned, I work for the Joint Analysis Center. I was an IT administrator lead for a couple systems. And what you see in IT typically is that they divide up the responsibility into sections. You'll have a network section. You'll have a Windows section. You'll have a Unix section, a data storage section, maybe even a specific email section, which we did have. And so you had experts in each one of these areas to manage the systems for that company, or for this instance, the Joint Analysis Center in Molesworth. Now, cybersecurity is ever-evolving. But what we see in the cybersecurity industry today is that you're a cybersecurity expert. You've got to know everything. Now, that's a very, very daunting task and one that quite reasonably cannot necessarily be done. So what we tend to do and what I do is I focus on an area of specific vulnerability. Yes, there's a lot to cybersecurity. And actually, what I like to use a reference, I'm sure many of you, if not all, are aware of Pixar and Disney animation of Shrek, where he references himself to an onion. It has layers, and I like to reference cybersecurity to an onion because it has layers. It is very fragile and very easily broken, but take, for instance, if you just break that skin at any location, then decay and necrosis starts to take effect inside that onion. And if that's on the edge of it where the whole onion comes together, you have all these different layers or, in cybersecurity, all these different technologies. And then if I just cut the end off, now I'm exposed into many different layers of cybersecurity. So to the final question of what would you recommend or what did you see, there's a lot of solutions out there, and there's a lot of very valuable and very needed solutions. And we all have to work together to provide this holistic approach. But my point is, if you remove that skin, this web interface, then you're vulnerable regardless of what you've got on the inside. And that's what we see time and time and time again in every single hack, is that they've all had vulnerabilities on the public-facing internet. And a final point that I want to make was made, and I don't have it right now, but it was not by us. But what they said is there's three things. One, if your public-facing internet is exposed, the cyber criminals know it. Two, they know they can get in. And three, they know because of this that your inside is also not protected and that you're not prepared for a cyber attack. So these are just indicators. So now if we eliminate that, granted maybe the state of Alaska and a few specific entities were focused, I want to attack this organization, I'm after this organization, fine. But if we look at the world in a bigger picture, they're not specifically attacking an entity because they have it out for that group or that organization. They see a target of opportunity based off the information that they have gathered through open source intelligence, the very information that I gather and eliminate. So by the elimination of those attack vectors, now that target of opportunity doesn't even pop up to the cyber criminals, and they move on.
And Mr. Stevenson, thank you for that answer. I'm going to have to ask you to maybe make the answers a little shorter in the future. We will be losing. We've already lost two senators. I do want to get moving on to executive session, but I see at least another question from Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I will have to say some of the acronyms had me a bit lost, but I was trying to keep up. I'll go back and read the document you provided. And if some of this needs to be moved into executive session, please do. But you did say in your opening remarks that the courts and the Division of Elections were notified by you and warned that they had vulnerabilities. And so what I'd like to ask you, because I'm thinking the public would like to know as well, how far in advance were they warned? What type of communication was that? Was that simply an email? Did you get any sort of response? And slightly separate but related question, when you're checking and warning, are cyber criminals able to detect that activity, and do they watch to see whether the entity takes precautions or not?
So that's a very good question. The first part, I'm not sure. Chair, am I able to answer that, or is that something that needs to be in the session?
I'll leave it at your discretion on that one. Probably hold off and put it into executive session.
Okay. So to the second part, no. What I do cannot be watched or monitored because It's my interaction with the server and the website. I send a request and I say, what's available to me? The server responds back and says, I've got these various applications, I've got these capabilities, and it provides a laundry list of information that what we don't see as average users gives us the web page and the infrastructure that we see before us that we can click on and use. So no, they are not tracking what I'm doing, but there are organizations that do report and track openly some of the stuff that other people use their tools to do, and then that is.
Locked up a little bit. I'm sorry, could you repeat like the last sentence you said? You had locked up, Mr. C.
Sorry. So the information that I do isn't trackable, but there are solutions that do parts of the information that I provide. There's a lot of solutions out there, and what we find is that they each focus, like the cybersecurity onion model, they focus on specific parts and not this entire infrastructure. But some of those website tools and applications can track and report on the discovery of cyber vulnerabilities. And so, yes, cyber criminals can use those tools to ascertain that, no, they are not using mine.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. Back to Senator Keel. I believe you had one more question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Mr. Stevenson, I guess the other question is, it's a question of, I guess, importance and resources, right? There's never enough money in any corporation and in government to meet all of our needs, much less getting into wants. And there's no question that we'd be more secure if we hired your firm and every other cybersecurity firm that focuses on a specific entity, and we're also broke. So I guess, you know, you talked about the Alaska legislature's website, and I won't ask you about specifics, but I guess my, I don't know how to think about this. I'm not a computers guy. I got a safety deposit box in a bank for the most important stuff behind keys and codes and cameras. I also have a safe at my house where the guns go and I lock my doors. But the garden hose and the rake, man, they're outside. There's not even a padlock. So I think the worst thing you can do with a legislature's website is notice a meeting that doesn't exist or file an ethics disclosure that says Senator Schauer is secretly a member of the board of directors of the Alaska Center for the Environment. Why should we be freaked out about the legislature's website and not focused on some of these other things where there's personal identifiable information?
A very great question again. So two things with that. First off, what I am presenting is, and as I've said, is commonly not implemented across the board. So when we come to the Alaskan government, we're not here on a witch hunt. We're here to help. And I've engaged with professionals in every industry. And the first from a cybersecurity and IT professional is they are affronted because of the information that I'm providing. And that is not the intent. The intent here is to help and educate and fix. Now, using your analogy, guns, obviously I love to shoot. I do miss it quite a bit. But in your analogy, you locked the safe, you locked the front door, but you left a few things outside. Now, what we're doing is we're showing that you actually left the front door wide open with the safe sitting in plain view wide open and your guns sitting on display. And why is that important from an Alaskan legislator perspective? The government's connected. Look at SolarWinds. They got in on a website in one location. It wasn't their end goal. I mentioned at the very beginning a very large IT corporation where we are currently tracking and monitoring a attack in progress. They have done the same thing that they did at SolarWinds. They spoofed a website. They've elevated their privileges. They've assigned a PKI certificate. And now they're very slowly finding where it is that they want to go penetrating. So from an Alaska legislator, yeah, you know, that's maybe not what they want. Worst case, they hit you with ransomware and or encrypt all your information or sell it on the Internet. But the real thing is what's behind the scenes throughout the government infrastructure that they can actually access. And this gets into critical national infrastructure. Things like power, water, sewage, they can get into a lot of these different things through these type of vulnerabilities, and it's all a matter of time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. The current plan will be, it looks like those questions are exhausted. Senator Kill, did you have any? She just dropped your hand. I saw that. My plan is to go to a brief at ease for about 5 minutes. We're going to break the team's links. We'll see if we can reestablish phone contact with everyone involved, and we will probably go into executive session planning on till about 11:30 or so. We'll see what happens time-wise, what we need, and then I believe we'll have to come back to close out the meeting. So at this point, a brief at ease, and if all participants would break your team's link, and if you don't, we'll do it for you. And then the numbers, once again, for anyone outside the U.S., if you have that 844-586-9085, and the other two numbers I'll send out by text for any senators who need it. All right, once again, brief at ease. I'll tell you before I do that, any last minute, any alibis from anybody? Seeing nothing, brief at ease. All right. The Joint Senate Judiciary and State Affairs Committee meeting is out of executive session. We're back on the record. We're going to wrap it up. Before I go to Mr. Stevenson, Mr. Stevenson, thanks so much for the presentation you made today. Appreciate your patience with our technology problems. Is there any question or comment from anyone on the committee? Any committee members?
Mr. Chair?
I heard Senator Hughes.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for hosting this and for extending extra time longer, I believe an hour more than we expected. And I want to thank the gentleman for being with us and informing us of some important matters for consideration. I have two quick questions, and the public heard the presentation at the beginning, and we heard that different scoring systems are used, ratings. And so I want to know whether the gentleman believes that as a cyber expert, cybersecurity expert, and other cyber security experts out there, whether it's achievable to go from an F, a grade of an F, for instance, to a grade of an A, and have cyber experts such as yourself been able to bring a state government to an improved grade? Have you done that with any state? And then as part of that, I'm wondering if there's a best practice for a state government as far as a one-stop shop, a portal for reporting and for someone making sure when there is a warning issued, such as you did, that is actually reviewed, and if that would might be a best practice that you suggest. I know you wrote the AG, and, you know, because cybersecurity issues can be criminal in nature, but yet it seems like someone that is really tuned into cybersecurity would be better, the better point of contact. So I just wonder if you can comment on a best practice for a state as far as a one-stop shop portal.
Mr. Stevenson, are you still available?
I believe he's dialing back in. We had gotten back on Teams.
There was,
this is Burke Stevenson. I'm in now.
Mr. Stevenson, please proceed.
No, I just
did you hear the
I'm
question?
Back in. I did not, sorry.
Senator Hughes, do you have an abbreviated version of that question?
Yeah, and I apologize to the committee to have to hear it twice. So the question, because the public heard you talk about ratings and scores and that Alaska has some insufficiencies, what are the prospects for someone such as yourself, a cybersecurity expert or another cybersecurity expert, to upgrade us to a better grade? And have you or any of your counterparts been able to bring a state government from a low grade, such as an F, up to an A? That's the first question. The second part is there a best practice, or could you suggest a best practice for a state government so when warnings are issued, they're not inadvertently ignored? For instance, when you wrote the AG, that's not really his area. Would it be better to have a portal such as a cybersecurity person that reviews anything reported, reviews anything from a cybersecurity expert like you?
Mr. Stevens?
Senator, yes. Thank you for the questions. Definitely. So to the first part of your question, directly with any state, have we improved it? No. With other organizations and companies, yes, we have. And there is a process that goes through. And as your IT manager very appropriately said, it all depends on, you have to analyze all of the findings, and maybe there's a reason something is the way it is, and that is understood and accepted. But you also need to determine what your threat thirst or you know availability to accept is, and each entity, each website is different, and that all needs to be taken into account. So can it be done? Yes. And typically what we do is work with your IT teams through that discovery and remediation process. With regards to the second question, that's a very, very tough one. Again, this industry is very large, and there's a lot of people. Like cloud was the buzzword 5 to 10 years ago and still going. Cybersecurity is one today. And I see it time and again, people commenting, inundated with the next best, greatest thing. And I completely understand that there's a lot of companies out there trying to provide solutions for whatever reasons. And how do you cipher and siphon through all the requests? Your IT teams could spend their entire time just listening to people trying to present their solutions. One of the things that obviously I hope makes what I do different is this is me more representing myself versus a company. Yes, it's on letterhead that I provided this presentation, but I'm an individual entity on my own right and actually am a freelance consultant for this company. It's just the company that I currently work through. And the solutions that we provide are irrefutable. I mean, the data is there. It's not something that we're pulling out of what ifs. We are actually showing live data based off of the interactions we have with the web servers. So to answer the second question, that is a very hard way. Yes, if you have a process, but even in that, it's like you said, there's emails that can be received, and maybe somebody in the staff saw it and decided not to forward it on. I mean, there's got to be a checks and a balances, because you've got to cipher through the chaff to get the stuff that is valuable. It's hard to say, and it's something that needs to be addressed probably within the state and your IT infrastructure specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. I heard Senator Schauer, you had a question or a comment.
I did, Senator Hall, thank you, and I'll make it a comment so we don't extend the time. I want to remind everybody that nothing here is classified. This is not even confidential. This is something that is open source information, as Burke has pointed out, that he is able to glean from things that are already happening that anybody can find if they have the time or ability to look for it. So I don't want anybody in the public or anybody that has been listening today to think that we're broaching some subject matter here that is somehow wrong or anything else like that. It is not. The point of this is to highlight just how vulnerable we are, just how much information is floating around, and get people to start thinking about, especially in the government, the legislature, how we need to dedicate time and resources, whatever that may be, to solve this, because this relates to many things that have happened to us. You know, secure elections, I hear that all the time. How secure are they when we know that we continually get hacked and people's data is out there that could be used? That's on the record in state affairs earlier this year. If that can happen, health and social services, information of, according to the commissioner, almost every Alaskan could have been affected by this, and how that could be used for data mining, how it could be used to do things, like you said, the third largest economy on the planet is cybercrime, and all the impacts that has the individual people, businesses, governments, et cetera. So I hope that people understand that this is important to certainly protect sensitive areas as we look to do our best to lock those down. But at the same time, this is not something we should shy away from or be afraid of, to include parochial empires where people are worried about it because they go, I work in this agency or whatever, and they feel like somebody's going to look at them and go, oh, my gosh, you're doing a terrible job. No. And Bert pointed that out as well as our IT director. That's not the point at all, because we have to identify these things. You can only defend a castle for so long. People will find a way into it. This is a continual battle. As anybody's been in the military, you know, you have electronic countermeasures and electronic countermeasures. The game never stops. This is a continual battle that will be around long after we're all gone. So I hope everybody finds value in this, and this is something we need to continue and figure out how we're going to dedicate resources to this, because this battle will not stop. And we will not have secure elections. We will not have secure health and social services departments. We will not have anything secure, and it never will be. As I say your name, Senator Holland, thank you for letting me say a closing statement. And I would implore all of us that this is just the beginning step. There's a long way to go, and I think that we need to do this again pretty soon and start working on solutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. I believe we might have Senator Keel and Senator Reingold still tuned in. I just wanted to give them, were there any closing comments from any other senators?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. All right. Mr. Stevenson, thank you for joining us today. I'll give you second to last word because I get last word. I get to adjourn us out. But did you have any closing comments for us?
Mr. Chair, Senators, my only comment is thank you. I appreciate when people actually listen, because what we have is information that we want to help get out. So thank you for that. And as I said, you know, we're here. I'm here on my own accord as an individual. I'm happy to join and assist in any way that I can, because that's what I would like to see happen. It is definitely progress. So, but in closing, just thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. I think the takeaway from this is that all it's going to take is probably time, money, and expertise and determination. But thank you for the presentation today. Sorry we went so long. Once again, thank you, Mr. Stevenson from CyberSec Innovation Partners for presenting the cybersecurity presentation today. That being concluded, is there any other business before the committee? I'll take the silence as probably not. With no other business before the committee, the Joint Senate Judiciary and State Affairs Committee meeting is adjourned at 12:11 p.m.